Welcome to episode 13 of More Than Just Maps. I'm your host, Ollie Powers. This podcast was created with the intent to help anyone in the GIS field get from where they are now to where they want to be that your first job, a career move, or just improving your GIS game overall. On this week's episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Jordan Carmona from the city of McKinney, Texas. On this special episode, Jordan and I talk about all things GISP. We share our own experiences of completing our portfolios, share tips and tricks to use to gather points, and explain exactly how the point system works in the first place. And now for part one of my interview with Jordan Carmona. On today's episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Jordan Carmona, who's a GIS analyst for the city of McKinney. Welcome, Jordan.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good. So before we get started, just want to let people know we're going to kind of do a little bit of a different episode for this month, or a couple episodes this month. So we're going to be speaking with Jordan, but we're also going to be discussing the process of gaining your GISP, seeing as there's not a lot of content out there for people who are trying to get that. We are going to kind of chat about how to go through that and some tips and tricks and just a little bit about it. But before we go through that, Jordan, let's get to know you a little bit better. So can you let us know just how you got into GIS, why you like it, what your first job was, how you got to from when you started to where you are now?
Okay, it's a bit of a laundry list, but I can do that. So the origin story is I went to the University of North Texas in Denton, and I did not study GIS. I was actually a history and political science dual major. So I graduated about the time that the 2008 recession was winding down. The job market wasn't great, and I was looking to kind of hide out in school for a few more years, maybe. So I was looking around at master's programs inside UNT. And that's when I walked into the geography department. And
you just randomly were walking around campus, or
I went building to building, picking up all the master's visuals and just thinking like, oh, could I see myself doing this or not? So then when I get to the geography building, right, it turns out like people get paid to make maps. Which is funny because over the last 4 years, all I did was like look at maps and read maps and like figure out like why things are the way they are. But we didn't really do like a lot of technical work. It was all like books and writing essays. And I was thinking like, wow, like had I known this was a thing, I could have been, you know, doing like computery type stuff, which I've always been interested in while I was doing my degree instead of just reading and writing.
It's not uncommon. A lot of people have no idea GIS exists until they randomly stumble upon it in school.
Right. So I started taking a few classes, just to figure out if this was something I wanted to do. They had like a certificate program, and about two semesters from when I was supposed to finish, I got offered a job at a IT and GIS consulting company. I just quit school. I was very excited for the stable paycheck.
Don't try this.
Of course I regret it now and I'm back in school. But at the time I thought it was like the best idea in the world.
Yeah.
So the IT GIS consulting company was fun. It was interesting. We had a kegerator on our second story. So it was kind of having, you know, like the startup vibe to it. Probably the best thing that came out of that job was, I guess, the vertical integration of all the GIS tasks. So instead of just being a technician and, you know, hey, cogo these parcels, exactly all day, every day, really got to do everything, you know, managed something like 70 SDEs. We went to clients' sites to do installations and trainings and sales calls, all sorts of stuff that I don't think I would have had an opportunity to do really outside of that environment. So it was an excellent resume builder and is what led me to get my current job at the city of McKinney.
And it's not bad to have that experience. A lot of people finish, they do go ahead and they finish their degree. And that's the kind of experience that a lot of employers are looking for in their interns or their new hires who are entry level. And of course, no one's going to have that because they've never had a job in the field before. So that's not a bad way to do it either.
Yeah, that's probably one of the harder things is the soft requirements for all the entry-level jobs is, hey, we want you to have a ton of experience that you probably don't have unless your school is really active about getting people internships or you as a person had the foresight of mind to be really active about internships in school. I think it's a tough row.
How did you move from that GIS IT job did you go straight to City of McKinney or was there something in between?
So there was a short stint at BNSF as a consultant or contractor, for about a month and a half. I had interviewed for the City of McKinney job and the BNSF job at the same time.
For those who are not familiar with BNSF, BNSF, it is a railroad.
Yes, it's a railroad. They're doing super cool stuff. So I interviewed for both those jobs at the same time. City of McKinney never called me back at the time. And so I accepted the job at BNSF. And it was sweet, you know, not to divulge trade secrets or anything, but we had four monitors set up to a single workstation. And we were helping build the positive train control, which is a series of automations that allow trains to have safety backup features. So a lot of it is digitizing items on the track from LiDAR. And then so the train knows, oh, hey, this is a speed limit sign for 20 miles an hour, so I need to slow down if the driver has not already slowed down or stuff like that. So super interesting. I was at the job for about a month and a half when City of McKinney called on my way home. I was like, yes, 100% yes, I will. Yeah, I would love to work at the City of McKinney because I was living in McKinney and I was commuting to Fort Worth. And for people that's a drive. People not familiar with the Metroplex, that's like an hour and a half or maybe 2 hours in traffic. So I was working, I was getting to work at 7 to like skip the traffic and then not having lunch and leaving at 3. So it was manageable, but man, it was. So I accepted the job at McKinney and it was super fantastic. They wanted me to kind of lead the geospatial capacity and capability building for the development services group, which is four departments: building inspection, code services, engineering, and planning. And so that's what I've been doing for the last 3 years. This past year, our IT GIS department has started working on re-centralizing all of the GIS teams in the city. So I got pulled into the IT GIS department, doing the same stuff, but I have two bosses now, and that's cool.
So I guess McKinney had a different GIS person for like assigned to each different department?
Yes. So we have mainly three GIS departments and more or less three departments that are active users in GIS. And that's the public works, dev services, and then IT GIS does infrastructure and helps out when, you know, people need stuff or maps or whatever.
So what's your favorite thing about working at the City of McKinney then?
Ooh, I actually just had this conversation last week about what I love about working at the City of McKinney is that I, not to sound flippant or anything, but I get to do what I want, right? So when I first started, my boss was not a GIS person. He's a performance management kind of guy. So into lean methodology, Six Sigma, Toyota production method, that kind of stuff. So anytime I wanted to do something, right, something shiny, it was flashing before my eyes, I just went to my boss like, hey, I want to do this because it'll help us do that. So it's okay. Like, it was never a, yeah, but let me check your methodology, or, well, I think you should kind of do it this way. It was always just, yeah, whatever you want. And given that kind of leeway has been fantastic. So I've been able to integrate non-spatial databases into our GIS, got them to buy me 2 drones. I'm working with, I got some more RAM on my computer so I can start doing Open Drone Map. I do a lot of programming. So really just about anything that I think is interesting, we end up being able to do. So that's what I love. That's what I love about McKinney, is that they're very much into the idea of self-directed work, and for people to make, you know, like leadership decisions at all levels, right? The person's closest to the work is the one that is most informed about it and should decide how it needs to be done.
And that's amazing. From sounds of it, that's working really well for you. Have you ever had any moments where you kind of wish there was somebody who, not really micromanaging you, but you could turn to be like, hey, I'm not sure how to go about this, and just have that guidance?
I would love it. Yeah, so that was probably one of the harder things, is the siloed nature of our previously decentralized model. It's, you know, so you've got cities that are paying 2 or more people to be GIS people, right? But when they're not sitting in the same area, the same office, you don't get those collaboration moments, you know, like, the sum of the total is greater than its parts. And I wholeheartedly believe that in terms of GIS personnel. You know, it's when you have like 10 people that are doing spatial analytical work, you don't have like 10 individuals. You have like 10 different points of whatever, to use an 80s word, like synergy or whatever. And you can like really kind of get a conversation going that is beneficial to everyone. But when you don't have that collaboration and we don't have that communication, you really feel like you're all alone on a desert island. So what I did early on after joining McKinney is I just used some of my past experience as a, gosh, what are they called? Telesales or whatever.
Telemarketers.
Telemarketer, yes. I had a brief stint in college as a telemarketer. So now anytime I have an issue, I cold call other cities, right? So if I hear about something in the news, you know, like with the Zika, so I ended up calling Miami-Dade and I was like, yeah, we want to do stuff with mosquito things. Can you help us out? So I'm constantly calling people that I don't know and asking them for favors. And for the most part, everyone has been super responsive. And then the other thing, of course, would be calling Esri, right? If your organization has a, it's current on their maintenance fees, call Esri up 100%. Yeah. Some of the other stuff that we're starting to do, especially because of the pandemic, is using Microsoft Teams a lot more. So we're slowly trying to build that kind of team unity and collaboration. We have a few different channels where we talk about like upcoming conferences and webinars. We have a shared Kanban board so everyone can see all the projects that are happening. Definitely, we have a ways to go on being a little bit more cohesive. But that's, you know, if you're in a city that's large enough to have multiple GIS personnel, it really is a wealth, and it's a resource that should be utilized.
No, and that's really great. Definitely not all cities are on board with that. I think almost everyone is having to get a little bit more creative with how they're working nowadays because of the pandemic. Just not being able to be in the office. So it's really good to hear that you guys are collaborating like that. I know the city I'm currently working for is not quite up to speed. Like, we don't have Microsoft Teams, which I was a little bit shocked at when I started there, but we're a 2-person department right now, about to be a 3-person department. So we're still very small, I think, compared to other people. But I'm glad to hear that McKinney is moving forward with that, especially with them trying to centralize everything. It's very common for cities to have very siloed departments. So I think they're on the right path with what they're doing.
We're thinking that way, right? So my manager and I have been going through the Slim Jim capability maturity model that was created by Paul Giroux. And that's been interesting, right? To kind of take a critical eye to our own organization and judge it and say, hey, we're not really meeting our expectations, and how do we get better? So all of these things are kind of top of mind right now for me.
Yeah, and that's really hard, especially if you're just doing that. And you got to make sure people who are doing it with you are on board, because you might do that and higher up leadership might not take kindly to that. And that could cause a lot of problems too.
Yeah, I'm a little hesitant because we haven't socialized it yet. We're almost done with it. We haven't socialized it yet to our executives. So I'm not expecting anyone to be any sort of way about it. But that fear is definitely there. You know, I've been in organizations before where challenging the status quo is frowned upon, right? And I think that every good employee should be challenging the status quo. I mean, obviously not in haphazard ways, but you know, if your eye is you want the organization to do better, I want that person on my team. I don't want someone that's going to come in 8 to 5 and leave. That's ugh.
No, totally agree. And that's actually a good segue to get us into how do you get quality people on your team. One of the ways that you can kind of search for that is with the GISP. So let's move into our featured content for the day and kind of get into the GISP. So I'm a GISP. Jordan, you're a GISP.
I'm a GISP.
Yes. So we're going to talk about the GISP. So before we really get into it, what are your thoughts on it?
They have evolved, I'm sure. You know, I think that before I was a GISP, it was something of a maybe kind of a sour grape situation. You know, the fox and the grapes and everything. It just seemed like such a huge hurdle. And so it's a little easier to nag on it than to try and pursue it. Now, after having gone through the whole process, I think it's helpful. I do think that it has some room for growth and evolution, which I'm sure we can talk about. But overall, if you're a GISP and you're in your resume comes across my desk, you know, I'm going to take that more into consideration because I understand the kind of pains and difficulties it took to get that. So I would probably weight someone a little bit better because of that, for sure.
Yeah, and especially I think newer GISPs, not to bash people who are grandfathered, but knowing there's an exam component now versus just I've been in the industry for 20 years, here's my GISP. I think that definitely, at least in my view, because I was one of the people who had to do the exam twice, knowing what it took to pass that exam, you have to put a lot of work and you have to have a lot of knowledge to get that. So I would definitely also give somebody who had a GISP certification a little bit more credibility than someone who does not.
I think the grandfather issue is a thing, right? People don't put what year they got their GISP. So for the government application, it's a little harder to kind of judge based on that. But I had someone in an interview, you know, talk about them being proud that they got their GISP in right before the exam deadline. Mm-hmm. And that didn't sit well with me, you know, after having done the exam myself. I was like, I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah. I mean, I understand it from their perspective, not having to do the exam, but having done the exam, I also feel like that should have been placed on those. When I found out about the GISP, it was about a year and a half before they had it instated the exam. So when I was first learning about it, there was still no exam component. And even just looking at the criteria of what you needed to build your portfolio to be qualified, that seemed really daunting to me, especially since I had just finished grad school at the time as well. So it kind of seemed like, oh my gosh, I just finished all this hard work and now there's this whole other thing to start building on. But having, and I was pissed when they announced the exam. I'm not going to lie. I was mad about that. And I was mad about the exam. There's a lot of stuff I was mad about. But now having gone through it, done it, I'm very happy I have the exam. That I did the exam and have my GISP with that. I think it just holds a lot more weight in general than it would have previously.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. That's... It was a bear, right? But anyone that tells me they did the exam, like, props, hats off to you. I love it. I feel like shared connection immediately.
Yeah. And also having worked in local government here in Texas, and talking with other different types of professionals who've also worked in local government, such as planners and engineers, hearing about their process to get their professional certifications, it's very similar to what GIS professionals are going through with the JISP as well. So that kind of makes me feel a little bit more legitimate, like, hey, we're doing the same thing they're doing. And people are trusting people who have their professional engineering, who are professional engineers, and they're who are part of the APA Planning Association. So why shouldn't we have the same thing for the GIS profession? I think it's a really good thing. So now you're talking about people who didn't know when they got their GISP. So I did a little bit of history background on the GISP. So the first GISPs were awarded in October of 2004. And there was, less than two dozen. And that's when they had, again, first started. They had spent years going over what the criteria was going to be. It seemed like this had been in the works for a very long time. From the early 90s, really, people have been talking about getting a certification together for the GIS industry. And it took almost 15 years to get that out to fruition. So when people start bashing, us included, people who have been grandfathered in, that still took a lot of time for them to get that together and even get that first step of the certification together. So I don't want to knock those who have not done the exam, just because this was brand new when it came out, and that seemed like a lot. But now, having gone through it, yeah, definitely. And as you said earlier, there's still work to do on this. I don't think it's perfect in its current form, but I think these are some really good building blocks, and we are making the right steps forward to get this where this needs to be. Now, you said if you had seen somebody come across your desk who was applying for a job and they had the GISP, you would consider that. Have you talked to other people in the industry and what they would do? A few people I've talked to don't even care about it. They're writing it off. And I don't think that's the right attitude.
So I don't think I've actually had this conversation with real life people. I have been a fly on the wall to several Reddit dialogues about this, and it seems a very stark divide of people that are going to hate on it because of what it is. You know, either give it no weight or actively disconsider people that have GISPs, and then the other group that says, oh, it's a great thing, or oh, it helps us get contracts. So I don't think I would love to have that conversation with someone in the area of what their thoughts are on it. I know that at least for the city of McKinney, in our hiring standards and stuff, a GISP is one of the recommended things, but it's not a requirement as of yet.
I think in North America in general, it hasn't quite drummed up a whole lot of support yet. I was actually shocked when I started getting job offers in Europe, and it was a requirement for those jobs. And I don't know if I was receiving these job offers only because I had a GISP, or if I just finally had enough experience that I looked like I knew what I was doing. but it seemed like in Europe, it's much more accepted than it is here in North America. And not having looked at the numbers, I just don't know how many people in Europe actually have this. So I don't know if that's just I'm being targeted specifically. Have you had anything like this happen, Jordan?
I have not. While I get plenty of offers to apply to things and whatever, I've not had any outreach outside of North America, which is kind of a shame. I would love, if anyone from New Zealand is listening, I would love to go to New Zealand or Ireland. I think those would be great. But no, I've not had that experience.
Okay. And that just might be something I've had, and it might not be very widespread, but that's just a small experience that I've had with that. So what are your thoughts then on the current process of building the portfolio? Let's get into this whole portfolio. Actually, let's take a step back. So for people who still are interested or they're not sure about applying for your GSP, and you think the exam is really daunting and you have to build this huge portfolio, it's not as hard as it looks for the portfolio. I'm not going to lie, the exam is a beast, but we promise you can get through it. you can actually take the exam before you have your portfolio finished. A lot of people that I've talked to, young professionals, they assume they have to have their portfolio finished before they take the exam. You don't have to do that. If you're in like a if you're partially in a computer science program and you have a good programming background from school, I would actually recommend taking the exam before you finish your portfolio, because you're going to have a lot of that information still fresh and top of mind. And that might help you with the exam a little more than, okay, I've been out of school for so many years, and then you get studying for the exam and you have to go back and relearn the stuff, because let's face it, you're not going to remember everything from school.
100%, right? A lot of people, when they get their first geospatial job, it is not great, right? You're a data entry person or whatever, or you're drawing stuff all day, every day. The test is the breadth of knowledge that you need to pass the exam is very wide, and it goes everywhere from network systems to how to create a schema, consultant type stuff, cartography, GPS. I mean, you name it, it's on there. The closer you are to school, easier it will be. I would still study for it, but for sure, taking the exam like I did after being in the industry for 4 years, it was difficult. And I think a lot of my experience as a consultant was super helpful. Had I not had those experiences, the exam would have been much harder for me.
So let's talk more about the exam a little later. Let's dig more into portfolio building. Mm-hmm. So there are three areas of the portfolio that you have to complete. You need 150 points total. And you have to have points in three categories, which are education, experience, and I want to say community, but I think they have a different word for it.
It's like contributions to the profession or something.
So pretty much volunteer or anything extra you do besides what you're doing in your job that is contributing to the GIS community. So for me, education was obviously the easiest one. It's enter the highest degree you got, enter all your coursework that you've done. And if you did your schooling in GIS, that's gonna help you a lot. Like you, Jordan, I started in school something completely different from GIS and randomly found the geography program while I was flipping through the course calendar, and then also randomly saw that, hey, you can make maps. This is an actual thing. That's really cool. And that snowballed me. So I took a little bit longer to finish my undergrad because I completely did a 180 of what I was going to be doing. So I had to do a lot of catch up in my courses. But I was able, I think almost every single class I took for my geography degree I was able to apply that to my GISP. So that helps a ton. Since you did, your degree was not in GIS, so how were you able to do that?
Oh, it was so hard. This is one of the things that I would change about the GISP if I could. I mean, I love that there's an education requirement, but it lacks kind of a certain sense of equity for people, that a lot of people fall into GIS. It's not a thing that they set out to do. And I think the GISP really penalizes people that come from the liberal arts or some other sort of cross industry type deal. Had I not started that GIS certification track, I don't really know how I would have gotten all of the education points outside of doing a bunch of paid training and stuff. A million webinars. Yeah, I was able to count, some of my physics coursework that was part of my undergrad, and I had to do a stats research class. So, I mean, I had a few things, but it was really close. It was uncomfortably close, and it made me, feel for those people that either don't have a college degree or only have an associate's degree, and it seems pretty high bar.
But that also says something, like we're expecting people who have the certification to really understand what they're doing. They're not just coming in and doing a hack and slash job and putting things together with WD-40 and duct tape. They actually understand the background behind all this stuff. So from your experience, it was obviously very, very difficult. On the flip side, the certification wants to build that foundation of and having the integrity and building that people who have this know what they're doing. They're not just making it up as they go along.
Yes, definitely. I see that point of view. I'm with it. You know, it's, if we want the GISP to be a measuring stick to put all professionals against, then it does have to have that high bar.
Obviously you were able to get through it, even though it was difficult. So it's definitely, even if you did your degree in something else and you've just come into GIS and you found it and you loved it and this is what you're going to do, it's not impossible. It is difficult, but not impossible. And that's the important thing to remember.
Yeah. Some of the strategies that you can take are non-accredited coursework. Mm-hmm. So I'm a member of SCOG, which is the South Central ARC User Group. $40 a year. Here's the pitch. $40 a year is your membership fee. And with it, we have a subscription to a GIS training company. And all of those have X amount of hours coursework, which you could use to satisfy your educational component. If you do some of the ESRI MOOCs, the massively online open courses, those have education component pieces as well. So there's definitely a way outside of paying tuition to go to school to satisfy that education piece.
And just another plug for SCOG, those courses are pretty high quality. And if you're looking for something technical, you're not sure how to do something, for $40, you get a whole lot of stuff. So that's if you're in Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana area, that's a good deal right there.
Yes. And a plug for our vendor, it's Geospatial Training Services. Their stuff is great. Wholeheartedly recommend.
Yes. Same. All right, so let's move on to the experience component. So this one's just more of a time thing. And this one they break it down into different levels of employment. So you can either be like a technician, or no, I think they have it as user, analyst, and then like a programmer level. So there's three tiers, and you get more points based on what level of usage you are working in. So I've been lucky. I was able to use mostly the second and first tier. I didn't have to worry about the third tier, which is lowest. And it still took me a little bit of time to get the full, because you need your 4 years minimum of experience, but then you also need to hit the point value for this experience tier that they've got, or this experience bracket. So they might not necessarily line up. So if you were in the third tier, the lowest tier as a user, you're going to need more time to get those points than if you were in the programmer tier. So what was your experience with that, Jordan?
So my first position, you know, a majority of the work that we were doing was drawing parcels, which left in me just a burning desire to never want to digitize anything again.
One of my profs fondly labeled that digitizing monkeys.
Yeah. And it's funny because we didn't even learn like how to do COBOL in school. Right.
When you're in school, you have no idea what, I don't want to harp badly on education, but I feel like you're just, as much as you need that formal education, there's still so much they just don't tell you.
Yes, definitely. So then we had, so one of the cool things it did, right, is at my first job, I got an internship program started. And so one of the perks that I got was being able to like be in charge of our interns. So I was able to get some of the management multiplier for about 6 months, which I was pretty happy with. But when I got to City of McKinney, my entire role just shifted dramatically. And I found that I was not doing data entry and I was mainly working on programming. Everything I was doing was systems level. And so I was able to get in right at about 4 years because of that. And it definitely helped. It definitely helped me to get the GISP when I did.
I would say the same. Before I started working in municipal government, all my jobs were probably that second tier, and not necessarily data entry. I worked as a cartographer for several years, like just straight up making like road atlases and other types of maps. And there's not a whole lot of people who have that cartographer job title anymore. So it was a little strange because I wasn't a user, but I also wasn't doing a whole lot of analysis either. So it was a little bit, I feel like I like just squeaked over that line to the mid tier. But then once you get into, I'm going to say local government because that's what I've done, but something that's using GIS a little bit more robustly, it just explodes with what you're expected to know and just the amount that you're expected to do with GIS.
Yeah, I think that the direction in local government is heading towards end users being responsible for their own data entry and the core GIS team being responsible for setting up applications and integrations and user requirements, all these kind of project management, business intelligence type things. I think that's really where everything is at right now. So that's also been my experience in local government, is that I was no longer doing data entry. Instead, I'm trying to build systems for other people to use and for them to do the data entry.
Yeah, for sure. I would say the same. And that's not to say that you don't do any data entry in local government, because you definitely do. But that's not what you're doing all day, every day. You're expected to have a much higher understanding of how the system as a whole works. And that might still be for like a technician level, like a very beginner level in local government. You might still be doing a little bit more data entry than an analyst or a programmer specialist might do. But I think as you move up, and if you like GIS, you're going to move up quickly. You're going to do less and less of that.
Yeah, I think that what you said is key. Is if you like GIS, right? If you're a believer, you're going to just eat, sleep, and breathe GIS, and you're going to annoy all of your non-GIS coworkers about how great it is and stuff you can do. And once you start doing stuff for people, they realize, oh wow, it's a force multiplier, and getting that kind of attention, yeah, definitely helps you up that ladder. You know, again, if you're just going to work to go to work, you're probably going to have that role that you're in for quite some time.
A very long time. And I know a few people who they're just there to do their job and that's it. And that's fine. As long as you're getting your job done, that's okay. But if you really want to go far in this profession, having the desire to see it grow and enjoy what you're doing, that's a huge thing. It helps you so much when you like what you do.
I mean, I can't imagine not liking what I do. I mean, I could, right? If you give me a big enough paycheck, I'll do whatever. But like, I enjoy going to work. I'm intellectually challenged. I like puzzles, all these things I get to experience at work every day. And that's great. I can't imagine just feeling stuck and bored.
And that's not to say that won't happen within the industry. There's definitely times where I've been sitting there working on something that's still challenging and it's pushing me forward. But I've definitely felt like, hey, why am I doing this? So it's definitely not to say that it's not going to happen, but as a whole, you're excited to be there. Everyone has days where they hate what they do. Like sometimes you're working on a project that you just don't want to work on. And that happens. But as a whole, I love telling people I do GIS. And the first thing out of their mouth is, what's GIS? And then you have to explain it. And I love explaining it to them what it is I do. And I think that shows through because they get excited because I'm excited.
That's okay. What's next?
All right. So let's move on to the contributions component. So this is where it gets a little bit of in the gray area, as like what counts in this. So Jordan, let's start with you. How did you find filling in the points in the contributions area?
You know, I had a strategy for it. I would wholeheartedly recommend everyone to identify what their strategy is and to pursue it single-mindedly. I think that the layup, if we want to use a basketball term, the layup of the contribution strategies is to be a member of GIS groups, right? So
yes.
Larissa, Texas is a free membership, and that's 1 point a year. So sign up right now, sign up today, and get your point a year for Larissa, Texas.
Yep.
SCOG, again, another a low-cost GIS organization. You know, for $40 a year, you really do get a ton, and it's...
money back from that $40.
10,000%, right? You could not buy a training package of 20 classes for $40, you know, and the people that are part of SCOG are really, like, really into it. You know, there's not a ton of conversations and stuff happening online, but going to the chapter meetings and to the annual SCOG meeting and meeting these people, you know, everyone's stoked about GIS. And so that kind of camaraderie is super cool. You know, then you can start some of the more expensive memberships, right? Would be like your AAG or your RISA International. But that was the first leg of my strategy is be a member of some places. So SCOG and URISA Texas did it for me.
For sure. And for those who are students, you can start gathering points as soon as possible. And if you're a student, both AAG and URISA International have incredibly low student pricing. I think it's like $10 and like $20 or $30. It's like below $30 for student pricing. So go ahead and take advantage of that while you can, while you're still a student, because those points will count. And like sign up for as many things as you can on a student membership, because for every year that you're a student, you can get into like four or five things. That's 5 points in that category a year. That's a ton. I think, what's the max in there? I think it's like 10 points you need, but they're very difficult points to collect. Very, very difficult.
So the other leg of my strategy is I still do it. I like writing. So I did my best to get articles published in a variety of GIS publications. So URISA Texas had a publication back in the day. I don't know. I haven't seen the Lone Star out in a while. No, so
we kind of dropped that one. It was really hard actually to get people to submit that. And it just got to the point where I think I wrote a couple of things for it and I was not confident with my writing in that. So it was just really difficult to get people to submit so that we could have something that would be relevant to our members and anybody who wanted to read it. So we kind of dropped that one and focused our energy on other points or other parts of the chapter that people are getting a lot more from.
So I wrote a few articles for URISA International and I've got published a few times and it was fantastic. They, again, the same kind of issue of always starving for content. So this is something that I would encourage everyone to do, because I like reading too, and I like reading interesting stuff, and I know that there's a world outside of my world, and it's great when people can transport you to their world, you know, just through the medium of written language. I'm still angling to get published an ArcUser. That's probably like my big goal for the coming year.
Like the pencil right there.
Yeah, the pen, you know, it'd be nice to like cut out a page and frame it. It'd be neat.
Hey, this article gets sent to everybody and their mom, because of course it's still being sent to my parents' house, because you can't get yourself off that ArcUser mailing list ever. Every address you've ever lived at will get that copy.
You can't tell, but I'm smiling right now because okay. There are ArcUser copies every quarter, just littered about the city in all the different offices that GIS people have ever worked in.
I was actually really lucky with the publishing, because I had published an atlas, or I'd been part of a team that had published an atlas. So that one kind of jump-started all my points there. I didn't think the atlas was going to count, but it ended up counting. They counted it for me, and I was kind of blown away. I was like, this is really cool. So if you can get on a team that's publishing an atlas, do it, because you get 15 points from that, or 12. It's more than what you actually need for the minimum. So if you can get that done, do it. Or not just an atlas. I think it's if you're publishing any sort of book. It's a book publishing, right?
Yes, there's a book publishing, and then you also get a high multiplier for publishing something in an actual journal. So for all the undergrads and grads out there that are putting their points in, even if you're not in a research program yourself, go find the research program at your school and offer your services to that team to do visualizations, maps, charting, any of that, because then you can get your name published if they publish, and that'll count for you. And not to mention, that's an interesting type of experience that doesn't require you to, you know, work for free with an internship. And it's definitely a nice story to be able to tell inside of an interview. And I think that's really what resonates the most with the interviewer and the interviewee, is being able to tell a story and show how spatial technology helps a thing. And, you know, being able to brush your shoulder and say you're published in a journal is kind of cool.
So I actually just finally pulled up the rest of the items for the contributions. So there's definitely publishing so you can get a book publication, but there's also the magazine or journal article. You can be on an editorial board. So I'm guessing that's for you're actually choosing what's going to be going into a publication. Does that sound right, Jordan?
Yeah. Yes. So that would be for probably if you were part of a GIS group that like Eurus International, right? They've got the GIS professional. They have a publication board for that. Or if your school has a scientific journal that they put out, you know, you could maybe angle for that.
Part of your strategy you said was becoming part of organizations and you're getting your points from that. So what was another part of your strategy?
The final thing, and I get that not for everyone, but presenting at conferences. I like to talk. I like to talk about myself and the work that I do a little bit. I get that this is hard if you're in a job that doesn't have a travel budget. You know, it can seem a little elitist to say, oh, we'll just go to a bunch of conferences and go present at those conferences. So I get that that's kind of somewhat raw, but for those of us that do have travel budgets, go to conferences and present at conferences.
How do you choose what to present? Because I've done a couple presentations and it took me a very, very long time I knew I'd want to present something, but I couldn't figure out what to present. And then I had a very strange situation happen, which I was then able to present on because it was very unique and I thought people would actually get something out of this. But had that event not occurred, I don't know that I still would have done the presentation. So how do you figure out what you want to present on?
So it's a mix, right? I do a lot of interesting stuff at work. So if I'm working on something that's particularly interesting, I'm going to present on it. And it's easy, right? Because you've already done the stuff, you got the deliverables, and you're just kind of telling a story about it and about how you did it. But the other thing that I like to present on are things that I don't see being presented. So for the last 2 years, you have lots of Learn ArcGIS Pro classes at conferences. You know, conferences usually have like classes either before the conference or after the conference that you pay to go to. In the last few years, if you want a cool presentation, present on, hey, this is how you use ArcGIS Pro. And it's low level or low effort, and that you just, you know, you're kind of showing people a few tools and stuff and what the interface looks like. And that's easy. Or things like, I just gave a presentation on ArcGIS Arcade, the scripting language that came out back in 2015 or something. And I've never seen a presentation on that at any of the conferences I went to. So I've been using it a lot in work. I thought, you know, this is interesting. And so I had a bunch of examples from some of the web maps that I made. And I just talked about, this is how you use Arcade. And you don't have to go into a ton of depth. Because for most people, it's a brand new thing to them. And you just kind of want to get rid of some of the mystery, some of the magic out of it, and then just say, hey, this is a thing like any other thing that you do during the day, and this is how easy it is to do. So I like to give presentations on things that I don't normally see. And then also the intersection of social relations or organizational dynamics. So I've given a few presentations on democratizing GIS and how do you deliver GIS solutions to end users that are not, you know, maybe technologically competent or kind of technology averse, and how do we, you know, how do we help our organizations use the stuff that we make? So those are things that I like to talk about. And if you think about GIS in that lens, that then you don't really have to say, oh, I did this really cool project. You just have to talk about how the spatial dynamic works in your organization, things like that.
And because we're going a little long on time here, quickly just go through all the other areas that you can use for the contribution. So we've gone over publication a ton, gone over our professional association involvement, conference participation work. So that's like setting up a conference, doing the presentations, as Jordan just finished letting us know how to go about that. You can teach a class. You can also get an award. This one's a really easy one. Make some maps and submit them into any contest you can find. I had quite a few points that I just submitted maps into contests and won them, which is, first of all, really cool when you win a map contest because you can say I'm an award-winning cartographer. And secondly, it's just fun to make them. So go ahead. Like, even when you're in school, no matter what level of work, like, no matter where you are, you can just do that, and that's fun. Volunteering is a huge one. Now, it's difficult to get the points from volunteering because they are so – you get a really low level of number of points per hour of volunteering, but that will add up over time. So if you can't get into anything else, go volunteer. They have other GIS contributions, and I'm saying that with air quotes. So organizing events, moderating anything, it looks like, that's related to GIS, and just any other community contributions that you can think of. So there's a lot of options you've got to get these points. All right, we're going to wrap up this episode, Jordan. But on the next one, we're going to dig into the exam in the next episode. So I'm glad to have everybody, and we'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Thanks.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Join us again for a couple of weeks for part 2, where we talk about GISCI Core Knowledge Technical Exam.